The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises. The penultimate college football playoff rankings are here, and are the Buckeyes more alive than we might have imagined? Coaching moves everywhere, including one that is a potential train wreck, though there is certainly a more fitting metaphor that is obvious. This is the College Football Podcast for Wednesday, November 29th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel. So, Pete, let's start with the College Football Playoff rankings last night. Abbreviated show of 30 minutes. Georgia still on top. Michigan moves up to number two. And maybe the thing that caught people's attention that I'm not sure is as big a deal as some might have thought, Ohio State slipping to six. Now, I think that's fairly appropriate, 6-7, somewhere in there. I think that's about the right spot for them at the moment. But I think there was this concern, thought, observation among some that that might somehow block Texas and or Alabama from jumping them after the conference championship games this weekend in the event that either or both of those teams were to win. I do not think that's the case. What do you think?
It's interesting, Reese. They would kind of need, so we've had this like year where the upset forgot, right? This is the, sometimes that happens in the first round of the NCAA tournament. It's just like total chalk, happens like once a decade. It's sort of been, we have not had that high stakes top five, you know, update. I looked the other day back through the CFP rankings for 10 years, and we've never had four undefeateds at this point. And you probably have crack researchers who can confirm that. I just clicked a bunch of times and looked. So it's just like it has been an anomaly. So we would have to have an anomaly Saturday while all of a sudden everybody loses, I think, for Ohio State to wriggle in. It's an interesting litmus. I guess I think the question, and you probably dialed in on this a little bit more than me, would be how many upsets would it take for Ohio State to make it?
I know the answer to that. It's easy.
Yeah.
Well, upsets, you're talking Vegas upsets, or let me say ranking upsets, because that's
easier. Yeah, ranking upsets, yes, because we're going off rankings here. Yep.
Oregon is favored over Washington.
By nine.
Yeah. And in fact, maybe it could go either way for Ohio State. Basically, the cleanest path, if you want to go by rankings, for Ohio State to get in as the least objectionable option would be Georgia, Michigan, Washington all win. They're 1-2-3. They remain undefeated. Florida State is upset by Louisville. By definition, mm-hmm. Those top three winning would mean that Oregon and Alabama have lost, and then you would need Oklahoma State to beat Texas. So basically what you're looking at is Louisville and Oklahoma State. If they win, Ohio State has a good chance to get in, I think. And it would be much like last year. They may still be, you know, in some people's eyes, because when I hear people say the four best teams, I am in favor of that. That is the charge of the committee. That's why we wanted the committee in the first place. But it is by definition subjective, right? So Ohio State might well be one of the four best, but when you start putting together the best team needs to accomplish something in order to be considered in that realm, I think that's when you wind up with Ohio State being the least objectionable option, because otherwise you would have teams coming off a loss. You would have, in Florida State's case, team coming off a loss without its quarterback. And by the way, I just want to say this, Florida State, I'm not against you. You know, I don't want to be hypersensitive to this. It's like, we've certainly had our fair share of Michigan doubters, but I brought up the fact that Michigan's strength of schedule particularly, is not appreciably different from some of the other ones, yet we can, you know, we're not dragging them into the equation. And the same is true for Georgia, by the way. Mm-hmm. So when you get down to all of these, everybody should be evaluated. That's all I mean. But as it pertains to Ohio State, if they are the least objectionable option, they would be at full strength. They would have one loss to the number two team on the road in a game in which they had the ball and had a chance to drive down and win. You know, so they would. That's the path for them. They need Florida State and Texas to lose. I think. And and then if, you know, if Oregon wins, then they're kind of in the, probably in that mix with Washington, because that would leave us with, you know, that, I mean, there are other paths. They're not likely, but they're possible. And they're probably in decent shape, falling only to number six last night.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I think this is the best championship Saturday, Reese, in the 10 years of the CFP. I don't even think it's close. I just think they're, the kineticism of all the different options are going to raise the stakes and are going to raise the interest level in every game. You're going to have a bunch of people in Central Ohio rooting for a mullet in Dallas, right? You just, you know, that's the sport gets fun when every corner of the country connects. You're going to have a lot of eyes on Friday night on that Pac-12 title game. I just think it's every game has big time stakes. And even, you know, the Big Ten game, like it would be interesting. Look, I don't think Iowa's going to win. You don't think Iowa's going to win. I was barely healthy enough to like field a team at this point. But like, you know, it would be interesting to see all around, like when something's close in the second quarter, somebody goes up two scores and what happens, and to feel the ripples of what could be as the day goes on is really going to make for a fun day of football.
Speaking of that Big 12 game and rooting for the mullet, and I actually think with Devondre Sweat, Murphy up front for Texas, this is a really bad matchup for Oklahoma State. But, and I know this is a different era of Texas, and you can't get too caught up in history. You know, since 2010, which was the first season when Texas started its conference championship drought, Oklahoma State's 9-4 against Texas.
I knew they would have had an above 500, like a winning record against them. I would not have guessed 9-4. I know Charlie struggled against them. Tom struggled against them for sure. Yeah, that old mullet, man, he's a crafty one.
He is, and I think I might have brought this up earlier, but I want to say it again. It bears repeating. If Mike Gundy beats Oklahoma in their final season in the Big 12, which he has, then teases Oklahoma with a backdoor path to the Big 12 championship game by falling behind 24-6 to BYU, then snatches it away from Oklahoma. I know that wasn't on his mind, but when you start looking big picture for fans and how Oklahoma State and Oklahoma view itself, takes that away from the Sooners last week, takes away their backdoor path to the Big 12 championship game. Then also beats Texas on its way out to the SEC. They all might be so happy in Stillwater, they might forget there's an actual trophy for winning the conference. Just that sort of catharticism and that vitriolic feel toward those two programs that they have. And if they could send them both out with devastating losses, I mean, I don't even know if they might forget to pick up the trophy in the postgame. You know, and as I said, I think I said this Monday, Gundy should never, ever, ever, ever play either of those two again unless it's in the playoff. That's the only way you should ever play them again.
Yeah, that's a great, like, philosophical question. Like, does winning your conference mean more than ruining the seasons of both your arch rivals the last time you're going to play them, or both your rivals?
It does. It really does.
Absolutely does.
Of course it does. Oh. But I'm being facetious.
It's so college football, it hurts.
Yeah. No, you think, you think it's more important to ruin things for your rivals?
I think the ruining of the rivals is more important than the, what will they remember, you know, 20 years from now in Stillwater?
You're right.
They're not going to remember, like, you know, Ollie Gordon holding the trophy on the stage for the Big 12. I think those individual matchups mean more than the league to them.
I think, you know, that's a fair point. Emotionally, it's probably true. The pragmatic side of me says that winning yourself, accomplishing something yourself has to mean more, should mean more. But you're right. There is some type of joy that it's hard to explain.
It's the petty, Reese. Yeah. We embrace the petty,
and I think they will.
There is some petty out there in the plains.
Oh, well, that's why they're not playing Bedlam anymore. It's all petty. This whole thing that we have schedules out to 2096 and all of that stuff and contracts we can't break. Yet we were able to cobble together schedules all across the country in 2020 on about a, you know, 3 days notice or something. So that's
Coastal Carolina played, I think, Liberty. Like they scheduled. Oh, no, BYU. They played BYU. They scheduled on a Thursday.
Yeah. Wait, it can be done.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Best in Game is brought to you by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises. Then Best in Game and Best in the Rankings, still the Georgia Bulldogs, 29 consecutive wins, SEC championship game against Alabama. And for Kirby the Great, there is still one more world to conquer, and that is beating Alabama in Atlanta, something that Georgia hasn't done in this SEC championship game era. In fact, the Dogs have never beaten the Crimson Tide in an SEC championship game and haven't beaten them in Atlanta. Also lost a national championship game on the Tua to Devontae second and 26 throw in overtime, the 2017 championship game. 2018, it was played in January. So a lot coming that way. College Game Day will be there. All kinds of guests coming in. We'll hear from the Pac-12 champion. All of those things coming up on College Game Day. And when Bill Connolly joins us in a few minutes, we're going to break down that game extensively and also talk with Bill a little bit about what is the margin when you start comparing strength of schedule ranks where it really matters. I mean, everybody knows if you've got a strength of schedule that ranks sixth, say like Ohio State, that it's better than Georgia's, which is 59th. But when you start saying, well, they've got the 39th toughest schedule as opposed to the 52nd. Is that one statistically significant? We'll get Mr. Numbers in on that because you start throwing the numbers around and maybe it doesn't really mean as much as people might think in terms of ranking those things. But the other storyline, Pete, that happens this time of year, something that you're up to your eyebrows in at the moment, all of the coaching changes. Elko to A&M, Indiana's making a change, Jonathan Smith to Michigan State, and then the theater of the bizarre, because as you texted me last night, only in this sport. Apparently, Bob Petrino is going back to Arkansas, not as head coach, but as offensive coordinator, which, look, I've got a lot of respect for Bob as a play caller and as an offensive mind. There's a political side to this, a structure side to this, a fan unity side to this that I do not understand, because if you start having success, and Sam Pittman wants to have success more than anything in the world, and that's great. If he thinks Bob Petrino's the guy, go ahead. But there's something inherently unsettling to the stability of the program, it seems to me, that if you bring in the guy who used to be the head coach, who has been responsible for their most recent glory days, if you want to call it that, at least the best Arkansas has been in a number of years, people are going to start calling for him to be in charge. And then does that fracture things even further? It's a strange hire and the second straight unusual offensive coordinator hire that Sam Pittman has apparently made.
Yes, I think it's fascinating in a lot of ways, Reese. Remember, we had talked about this on the pod sometime in the middle of the season. Pittman has that interesting clause in his contract where if since 2021 he falls below 500, the buyout drops significantly. So he is a game or two above 500. He beat Florida and then FIU late in the year. They had been in a pretty good funk before then. So next year you're going to have the duality for Sam Pittman of, if they lose, people are going to say, oh, his buyout's cheaper now, they're like 25% cheaper now. Maybe they're going to fire him. Or if they win, people are going to say, oh, it's Bobby Petrino. You better watch your back. So if the offense goes, and look, Bobby Petrino is a maestro of offensive play calling.
Yes, he is.
He has been. They were actually not great at A&M this year, but they were pretty good. But he has a long history. But he also has a long history of duplicity, right? If you go back to JetGate, if you go back to the Falcons, if you go back to all the, you know, the secret interviews and the times he stabbed Tom Jurich in the back. So, and then obviously there was his downfall at Arkansas. But it's college football, man. People don't remember the neck brace. They remember the, I think he was 21-3, something like that, his last 2 years. Maybe a little more than that. But it was, I believe it went Sugar Bowl, Cotton Bowl, or Cotton Bowl, Sugar Bowl to end it. So, look, he had Arkansas, a teeming, vibrant factor in, you know, in the rugged SEC West, you know, when it was really rugged. He had great players, great skill, great quarterback development. I mean, there's a lot of good there. But it is just a quintessentially college sports embrace of someone who brought your university national scorn with the way they did it. And my understanding, Reese, and this is very college football too, in order to do this, because he was fired for cause last time, obviously, he hired his mistress and lied to his bosses. Mm-hmm. That was really like what happened. He didn't get in a motorcycle accident. The motorcycle accident revealed all the other things. And so the president of the school actually had to sign off on this, because if you're fired for cause at Arkansas, there needs to basically be a presidential pardon to bring you back. Mm-hmm. So Bobby has been pardoned. And he will be back calling plays. I will say this to Bobby Petrino's credit. I made a lot of calls to A&M yesterday because Arkansas, to the highest levels, not surprisingly, was vetting him through A&M. Mm-hmm. Hey, what was he like? How did it go? Were there any issues? Mm-hmm. And he had a very quiet year off the field at A&M. There was not tension. He was a good guy in the building. He treated people well. Bobby Petrino did not treat people well at every stop. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty consistent theme of his. Interpersonal relationships is not a strong point of his. Calling plays is. So give him – and honestly, when he went to Missouri State, he kind of disappeared for a while. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to sit here and proclaim Bobby Petrino's a changed man, because Leopards have spots and everything, but there was enough self-awareness and humility – where he went to Texas A&M and, you know, stayed in his lane and did his job and did it fairly well.
I always want to be willing to forgive people, because all of us have fallen short. You know, all of us have had things happen that we would like to do over and take back. And I don't think, I don't think sometimes if someone has a misstep, no matter how egregious, there are lines. Obviously. So let me rephrase that. Not no matter how egregious, but there can be pretty significantly egregious missteps that, you know, that can be forgiven. Because this comes to, I mean, I know the situations aren't analogous, but it reminds me of, say, when Michael Vick had the dog fighting thing, got in trouble, and then when he had, you know, served his punishment, people said, well, he shouldn't be on a football team. And I look, you can have that take if you want to. But my question then becomes, if someone has fallen short morally, ethically, legally, or whatever, what will you allow them to do? You know, can they work in your insurance company? Can they work in the service industry? Would you want them working in your, you know, in your store, your business, your, what would you let them do? So once penance has been paid, then I don't have a big problem with, you know, Bob Petrino being back in the mix. I do think it's odd from Arkansas' standpoint that they would want to invite the litany of neck brace signs that they're going to get, the litany.
The internet had fun yesterday,
Reese.
Yeah, I
know. Yeah, the litany of motorcycle jokes that they're going to get. Now, maybe it'll go away. You know, it'll pass, and the first time he comes through, it's no big deal. I also think that
Those SEC student sections are forgiving.
Yeah, right. But, you know, maybe they'll go on to the next thing, you know. So maybe this will work out because he has been humbled for sure. And, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for him to stay in the SEC. But I do think that, you know, that danger is there. I don't know if danger is the right word, but the possibility is there for just what we outlined earlier. But I'll say this for Sam Pittman. If he is secure enough to bring in Bob Petrino to Arkansas as his offensive coordinator, I would probably lean toward going to the Mike Gundy method and going and finding some guy that no one knows about. But Sam Pittman doesn't have the equity at his place or the latitude at his place to go take a chance on somebody, you know, from Division III who's tearing it up. Mike Gundy does. So Sam Pittman needed to find more of a proven commodity, and I guess he's secure enough to do it. And hey, you know, on this podcast, we root for things to work out. So I hope it works out well for Sam and for Bob, who for all of his issues, you know, I've had no personal dealings with Bob Petrino that were particularly unpleasant, you know? So, I mean, it's, you know, so I don't wish him ill. I hope he and Sam get along famously, and Arkansas is rocking next year. It'll be interesting to see for sure.
I'd like to see the genesis of that idea if it came closer to Walmart headquarters or Sam Pittman's office.
That's a fair question.
I got a feeling where that graph would trend to.
Me too.
And that, I'm a bit of a cynic, as you know.
Yeah, and so. it further underscores just what we were talking about at the beginning, because if you're not in charge and making your own hires, then demise almost always just around the corner. So we'll see how it goes. I hope it goes well. Sam's likable. He's a friend of College Game Day. He's funny when he comes on, and he seems to be a really good guy, and you root for good guys to do well. So hopefully he will. What's the other hot button coaching issue you're following right now, Pete?
Well, Sean Lewis landed at San Diego State on Tuesday, and I think it's really a really good move. San Diego State's a place where the stadium was empty this year. They were sub 100 in offense on a lot of things, and they need to stand out, Reese, in a pro market, right? You're competing with the Beaches. You're competing with the Padres, and they have Snapdragon Stadium, $300 million. That's their final crown jewel to try to get, you know, snapped up by a Power 5. And they need a team that people want to go watch. And Sean Lewis's teams are always exciting. They score a ton of points. The COVID year always stands out to me because they led the nation in both yards and points when they were playing the MAC-only schedule. He obviously had those, like, grueling triple out-of-conference. You know, he would have to play three road games, like Oklahoma, Washington, Georgia, stuff like that. Like, crazy stuff when he was at Kent. But you have an instant identity right now. You think San Diego State football, you know, in your mind what it's going to look like. There's going to be wide splits, fast tempo, ball going down the field, pushing it. So I think a really good match. It obviously didn't work out for Sean Lewis with Dion, although he did give him some nice moments of excitement on offense. And really, I think developed Shador Sanders, which shouldn't go overlooked into an NFL prospect. But so I think that, and then, you know, the Boise situation is interesting, Reese, because it doesn't look like they're going to fill it this week. And there's a very good chance on Saturday, it'll be a good game. I think they're 3-point favorites against UNLV, the Fighting Barry Odoms, as we're about to bring Bill Connolly in here. And if Spencer Danielson hoists that trophy above his head and passes it on to, Ashton Genty next to him, that's a pretty powerful thing. That's a powerful thing for a university president to say. We don't want that guy hosting the trophy. We're going to bring in someone else. So it'll be interesting at Boise what happens there. Spencer Danielson has the players lobbying for him publicly, carrying on their shoulders, dumping Gatorade on him. And he's really been a electric bolt of positivity at a program that had clearly been mired in a negative time. So it's been fun to see those guys come alive, to see Boise back as the brand we know it. And he has clearly done yeoman's work in revitalizing that place in short order and giving him a chance to win a conference championship.
And the question then becomes, is he a good interim coach? or is he the guy for the long haul? Because a lot of guys have caught that bolt of energy. The king of catching that bolt of energy is my friend Ed Ogeron, who's done it, you know, on a couple of occasions, very notably. And Brian Harsin is lurking right there. Is that the other option?
Harsin's not.
That's not it.
He's not an option.
That's not it.
No, that's not
going
to happen.
Is he getting back in?
I have not heard of him in the thick of any head coaching mixes. So, there's fired coaches are tricky, man. Even when they've been really good, like that's just I always say in the market generally, not specifically to Brian. Fired coaches tend to overestimate themselves by like 30-40% because they see the good. And look, the Brian Harsin good was really good, mm-hmm. Reese, right? Yep. You're winning Fiesta Bowl, like it's really good. But the world remembers Auburn. And you have to go back channel and work hard in the search industry and network with ADs to help them remember the Boise. Mm-hmm. So
I remember I've probably shared this with you before, Pete. I had really appreciated Gus Malzahn with a really candid conversation that I had with him right after he took UCF. And, you know, I said to him, generally speaking, Gus, I'm not a coach, obviously, but from observation, it's always seemed to me that a fired coach is better off to take at least a year off, recalibrate, and kind of, you know, because it's so raw. I mean, no matter if you mm-hmm. see it coming, no matter if you think you got host, when you get fired, it's painful. You know, it's an injury. It's an assault on who you are.
Yeah.
And Gus said that was my plan, but then this job was so good that you know it had so much potential that he felt he couldn't pass it up. Now I think he's done a very good job there this year. You know, especially finishing strong, and I think they'll continue to grow in the Big 12. But it was interesting because I think generally speaking. You know, a guy like Harsin now has had some time off, but you also, the flip side of it is if you take the time off and you disappear, it's a little harder to get back in because the last memory is the thing got sideways at Auburn. And
yeah,
you know, so
yeah. Harsin's been spent around a lot of time. His son is like an FCS level quarterback. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's been taking trips with him and doing that and really engaged, which is good, man. Yeah. These guys live crazy lives, Reese, right? Like they're, you know, they work 80 hours a week. They don't see their family. So
how can he afford, the guys who do afford take, that?
some of the money from your wife's family gets it donated to Auburn probably that got does, diverted.
I did mention the pain, and I'm sure there was someone listening going, yeah, I'd love to endure some of that pain for, you know, I don't remember what Brian's buyout was, $20 million.
Bobby Lauder LLC, yeah. I think it was like $15
million. $15 million. He didn't quite get what Gus mind, did. So. Gus got $20
yes, exactly.
And nobody gets what Jimbo got to be able
no,
to.
No, no, it's ahead. Jimbo's still triple everyone.
Yeah.
Triple.
That's pretty amazing. Do you remember when Gus got bought out? It was $20 million, and people
and it was
were flabbergasted by it.
Clutch the pearls.
Yeah. And now it's like, yeah, that's nothing. Forget that $20 million. We got Jimbo over here getting.
I got that change in my pocket here. Let me get that.
And Pete, we now welcome in Bill Connolly for the highly anticipated portion of this podcast known as the Barry Odom moment. And we have it coming this weekend, Bill.
Yeah, that's right. Had to wait until Sunday morning to find out if the ancient computers would allow them to play in the game, but it worked out pretty well. I'm afraid I keep meaning to go look for that old 25-year-old Barry Odom jersey, but I'm afraid it won't be there. There's like three bins where it could be, and if it's not in one of those, then it's, you know, been lost to time, and I'm afraid to find out the answer there. But at some point, if they win this weekend, I will absolutely go dig out the old number 39.
You have to wear it on the pod.
Oh, okay.
All right. I think that's fair, right? Like, if I had given you a bet this year and said, Bill, you have to do something if UNLV wins the Mountain West.
That's right. I would have probably been okay with taking that on, yeah.
Hey, Bill, I want to break down some games with you, but from your expertise in numbers, as I was going through things last night after the rankings were revealed, and maybe I've posed this question to you before. Strength of schedule ranks. I mean, it's really easy to say, you know, well, I'll look at a couple here, for instance, and say Oregon's got the 62nd ranked strength of schedule, while Texas has 13th, you know, and Florida State has 56th. Where is the line where it's statistically significant? Because we can say, well, 46 is better than 52, and it is. But what is significant? How much of a range before you deem this something that is meaningful?
Yeah, that's a good question. The way I chose to look at strength of schedule, I kind of avoid posting. For a long time, I hated strength of schedule rankings because I had SP Plus, which is schedule adjusted. And so I would say, you know, they rank second in SP Plus. Their strength of schedule is 60th or whatever. And then people would say they're number two, but with the only the number 60, they would like double count strength of schedule basically. And I always tried to avoid that, but I did find a use for it just by looking at like, what's the likelihood that you would be that an elite team would have your record with your schedule? And that's kind of the way I've gone about it. Georgia, for instance, like the average top five team against Georgia's schedule would have a win percentage of about 0.88, which let's see, for a 12 team schedule, that's basically 10.5 wins, and they've won 12. So there you go. That's, they've won 1.5 more games than expected, with their schedule. So that's good, even though it's a mere top 50 schedule. Alabama's schedule ranks 16th. It's going to jump up to like second after playing Georgia this week. But that the win percentage there is still just 0.833, barely any different. And an average top five team would have 10 wins against their schedule. So we're not really talking about, if you're a top five team, you're winning most of your games anyway. And a lot of strength of schedule ratings end up kind of overreacting to playing, say, really bad cupcakes as opposed to normal cupcakes when a top five team would win those games no matter what. So I do think we kind of, by this point in the season, most of the schedules have challenged top five teams a semi-equal amount, and it all kind of gets lost in the wash, so to speak. Michigan, even at this point, is up to 54th in SOS because they played Penn State and Ohio State, and they won those games. So, at this stage, everybody kind of clears the bar, I guess.
So, Bill, earlier in the pod, Reese and I were diving into some chaos situations, right? Like, who doesn't like a little, get your Bunsen beakers and mix it around and see what could happen. Walk us through one or two of your favorite chaos scenarios here. There's the no SEC scenario.
Right.
There's the everybody loses and the Buckeyes backdoor in scenario. There's a couple different fun ones floating around. When you look at the anomalous amount of teams that could end up in the four, which has to be more than any time in this, in this playoffs history, that have real cases. What are some just different scenarios and situations that you've kind of concocted with your Dr. Evil hands?
Well, I do think Alabama beating Georgia creates a massive unknown. Like, we can't say for sure what will happen if Alabama beats Georgia. Maybe Georgia just falls to fourth. Because Alabama, one of the things kind of hurting Alabama right now is Texas. The simple fact that we know the committee almost in, like, it's like a legal requirement. If two teams are close and team A beat team B, we're going to put team A over team B no matter what.
Sure.
And so,
especially they won on the road too.
Right. Like, I mean, it was a good win. Like, I'm not wanting to downplay it. I think overall I treat head to head as less applicable than others, but it doesn't really matter in this case. It's a very important win. But yeah, I mean, if Alabama beats Georgia, are they kind of prevented from jumping Georgia by the fact that Texas is right there and has to be above Alabama, and therefore we end up with like Georgia 4, Texas 5, Alabama 6 or something like that? I don't know. So the unknown is the most chaotic scenario to me. Obviously.
So do you think Alabama pulls Texas with them?
Well, that's kind of what I'm wondering.
Yeah. Okay.
Except then Georgia blocks both of them because they're too far ahead right now. I don't know. This is a scenario we haven't really seen. A team as low as eighth producing a massive win and having the Texas factor. I don't know how that plays out. So that's intriguing.
Are you surprised to me just because Texas is that low? I guess somebody has to be eighth, right?
Right. Like, that's the issue. Is it's so crowded this year. Yeah. Ohio State wasn't probably going to fall all the way to like seventh after barely after losing by 6 points to the number two team on the road. And so somebody has to be seventh. And so in Alabama's case, somebody has to be eighth. And it's just, it's a very crowded field. Now, Texas loses. If, you know, Washington beats Oregon, I guess, and officially eliminates Oregon, stuff starts to clear up a little bit. But yeah, right now we are, this is a very, very 11-1 Alabama would never have ranked eighth heading into the final weekend before this year.
Stack the one loss resumes. Mm-hmm. If it's Georgia, Ohio State, and who else could be in that cluster then? I guess, you know, Oregon can't.
Or maybe Oregon or Texas.
Maybe Oregon, who could be a conference title winner, which would differentiate them. Stack up some good one loss, because, man, you are going to be, there would be hair splitting. This is definitely the year, Bill, where the committee is going to be getting a lot of mail from a certain zip.
Well, maybe. Or it's the easiest committee selection ever.
You got
like
four.
That is the funniest part of this whole thing. It kind of fits the whole MO of the year, which is basically everybody looks wobbly and we look like we're almost to chaos, but then all the favorites win and it's easy. If that continues, if we just have Georgia, Michigan, Florida State, and the winner of Oregon, Washington, that's the easiest selection we've ever seen. But yeah, we're just an upset or so away. And everybody says Michigan's kind of safe. I wouldn't want to find out. If you're Georgia or Michigan, I don't think I want to find out that I'm safe or not. If Texas beats Oklahoma State by 50, which they're either going to do that or just lose outright, I'm pretty sure that's Oklahoma State's way. There are a lot of scenarios here where just any sort of loss is a very, very, very damaging loss. And, you know, that's fun. It'd be a lot more fun if we actually have one of these upsets at some point and we haven't all year. But that was the craziest thing, by the way, that I found as I'm piecing together my Friday column. The teams in the top eight right now, which include, you know, the top four to start the year, plus ACC favorite Florida State, and what, Big 12 favorite Texas and Washington and Oregon, against teams outside of the top eight, outside of each other, basically, those eight teams this year are currently 89-1. Only Texas has lost to Oklahoma, which is obviously not, in most years, would not be a damaging loss at all. That's the only time one of these top eight teams has lost to a team outside of the top eight. So that's wild, especially since we spent most of the year talking about how, you know, nobody looks amazing and it looks like anybody's vulnerable and all that other stuff. Well, it turned out nobody was vulnerable in the end.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Give me, Bill, Friday night, Pac-12 title game, Oregon, Washington. Obviously, ESPN Analytics gives Oregon a 76% chance to win. Ducks, as we sit here, are like 9.5 or 9-point favorites. Give me one factor in that game that your numbers are fluorescent on.
Yeah, I mean, the main factor is, I think since Oregon, Washington, Oregon has exceeded projections by about 9 points per game.
Wow.
And Washington has underachieved against projections by 8 points per game. That's why the line has flipped that much. I mean, this was a game that, what was it, Washington -3 the first time they played. I think my SP Plus ratings had it Washington by 2.2. Now it has Oregon by 8.4. They have trended in dramatically different directions. And I know Michael Penix has been banged up, and it kind of looked weird on the sideline at the end of the game, like he was hurt, his ribs were hurt or something. It was hard to tell from TV, and of course nobody's going to say a word about it this week. But that's the two teams have trended dramatically in different directions, and that's the biggest factor. Washington's offense is still really good, but isn't, you know, the number one offense anymore, and the defense is, well, I mean, defense, I guess, has been okay. They've allowed 20 and 21 the last 2 weeks, but Oregon's offense is a completely different animal. And honestly, you know, Oregon was probably, you could make a case that Oregon was the better team the last time they played. It was just Washington won 5 of 6 fourth downs, and that made that allowed them to catch up, so to speak. So, yeah, I that's the two teams have trended in dramatically different directions, and Oregon looks as good as they have all season, and Washington's got ground to make up. If it's close, we know they're going to play brilliantly in the clutch, just like they did against Oregon and Arizona State and Utah and Oregon State and Washington State and USC. But, you know, that's they'll have to keep it close first, and Oregon could threaten to really kind of hurt them early.
So, Bill, as you look at the ACC game, and Florida State still holding firm at number 4 in the college football playoff rankings, but the offense didn't get a lot done in the swamp, but Rodemaker managed to game well. Has an opportunity to improve, and Louisville had a disastrous performance. In fact, I think I counted at least 4 to 5 times that Jeff Brohm referred to it as ridiculous. So what is what stands out about that to you? What do you think turns the ACC championship game?
Yeah, I think it probably comes down to two things. I mean, number one, Louisville has been such a good big play team this year, especially in the run game. The passing game hasn't been nearly as explosive over the back half of the season, but they just have a lot of big play threats. And if they can get a couple of chunk plays and really, really put pressure on that FSU offense, then this game is, you know, defined in the Cardinals' favor. And Florida State is very aggressive on defense. They're very efficient. They force lots of three and outs, but they can get hit. They can get hit by some big plays, and that'll determine a lot of how this game sets up. The other thing is just, you know, Florida State in general, I guess maybe it's kind of the same deal on the other side. They're, you know, Louisville's very efficient on defense. They can force plenty of three and outs themselves. And what we saw all year was that, you know, Jordan Travis didn't have to do a ton. They were usually kind of in control, but they'd fall behind schedule a little more than you'd expect, and then he'd bail them out. He was really good at the 3rd and 6s, the 3rd and 7s, and that's a lot of pressure on Rodemaker if you're putting if Louisville scores a couple times early and then puts him in 3rd and 8. That's not what you want your backup quarterback to be handling. So Louisville's also aggressive and can give up some big plays. Florida State obviously has nothing but big plays in the run game. It's all 0-yard gains or 30-yard gains, and those are kind of, that balance is going to be kind of interesting. You could almost see this setting up as a blowout either way, with Florida State maybe being slightly more likely, but it could still go either way, I think.
You know, the thing with Rodemaker is that his crowning moment of his Florida State career, at least up until this point, came against Louisville. You know,
yeah,
in a different regime for Louisville. You know, it was the pre-Brohm era, but you know, I would imagine, I think you're going to see some improvement from week to week. He's got another week in which he knows he's playing. Probably settled some of the nerves. It's not going to get any more intense than the rivalry game against Florida in the swamp, falling behind and having to come back. What did the efficiency say last week against Florida as opposed to what we had normally seen from the Seminoles up to that point in the season?
They were able to they got enough big plays out of the run game, obviously, especially the one at the end, to kind of ice the game with 3 minutes left. They got enough of that they didn't have to ask Rodemaker to do too much. He threw 12 for 25 passing. Against a better defense, that's not going to cut it. He's going to have to be a little more efficient. And who knows, like if they hadn't been running the ball well enough, maybe they would have put a little more on his plate. Maybe he would have handled it fine. Mm-hmm. But you do figure more of it goes on his plate in this game. That Louisville's got a better offense than Florida, I guess. Like Louisville's been all over the map, but I think they still have a better offense than Florida. And, that's what it comes down to. He wasn't very efficient. He made just enough plays to keep things moving, especially after a poor start. He did get, I think, better over time. And That's the game. Yeah, he will be asked to do more. This is a big stage. It won't be more intense, but it'll be more important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if he responds reasonably well, Florida State has more talent than Louisville. But without Travis, that's not a huge gap, and he's going to have to come through.
I would think, like, we're going to see Louisville, like, bring the kitchen sink. We've talked a few times on this pod about how that Louisville defensive unit has been one of the biggest surprises in all college football this year. I don't know if my Ron English for Broyles campaign has caught any steam, but just a fantastic job resuscitating a unit that was pretty pedestrian the year before with some portal changes, but not, you know, they didn't go get a whole new roster there. Right. And I would just think the Jeff Brohm mentality offensively is push, 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 aggression, aggression. And I would think defensively they are going to try to confuse flummox, hit, blitz, Tate Rodemaker to death. Like, Jeff Brohm is not going to coach conservatively in this game in any way. It's just not in his DNA.
No.
There are going to be trick plays. There are going to be shots. He knows they're an underdog, and he knows how improbable it is they have this opportunity. And I think the game plan will unfold as such.
Yeah, last I checked, he has one of the best records against top 10 teams of anybody. He knows how to play as an underdog. And you're exactly, I was going to mention trick plays. You're exactly right. They know how to surprise teams. Even when teams are expecting a surprise, they still get surprised. This isn't necessarily the coach you would want to be going against when you're one game from the playoff.
Earlier in the podcast, we talked about the success that Mike Gundy and Oklahoma State has had over the last decade plus against Texas. And we talked a little bit about the euphoric feeling there would be in Stillwater to send Oklahoma first and now Texas off into the SEC with a big loss. And if you are looking at a statistical personnel XO matchup, I can't imagine a worse matchup than relying on the running game, even if you have the nation's leading rusher against that Texas front. I think this is a really difficult matchup for Oklahoma State from a personnel XO standpoint. Do the numbers back up my eyes?
Yeah, I joked to my editor this week. The one thing I'm confident about in this game is that Texas will be up 24-7 in the second quarter. One of the two teams will then go on a 31-0 run. And with Oklahoma State, the way Oklahoma State operates, it really could be either one. They're going to look poor early. Texas is going to take control. And then if Gundy magic happens again, everything gets weird and messy. But you're right. I mean, Texas's vulnerability is big pass plays. Oklahoma State doesn't make big pass plays. They get all of their explosiveness from the run game. They just kind of use the pass as a pressure release kind of deal and you know, get Bowman some quick looks for 8 yards downfield. But Texas is very efficient against those looks and very good against the run. And yeah, they're going to have to figure out a way to get Ollie Gordon 3, 4, 5 huge chunk plays. Otherwise, they're just not going to move the ball very well. And, you know, I mean, if you get past the line of scrimmage, like, you know, maybe that's possible. But it does look like if Oklahoma State wins this game, it's going to be with turnovers. It's going to be with forcing mistakes from Quinn Ewers, mistakes that he hasn't made nearly as many of this year. And, you know, that is a possibility, but it doesn't feel like the odds are amazing. I mean, that's why the line is what it is. Texas is obviously the favorite in this game. And I think I didn't see where the line was this morning. I think my numbers like Texas even more than the sports books do. But yeah, that's why.
It's because your numbers can't quantify the magical power of a mullet, Bill.
Well, and just this team, this Oklahoma State team, even when they look good, they have to look bad first. They really enjoy the taste of blood in their mouth, apparently, and they can't relax until they've made a few crippling mistakes. So, again, like, they could make a big dumb run in the second and third quarters and make this a huge pressure situation late, but Texas is obviously the better team here.
That BYU game, to me, was just a microcosm of their season in 60 minutes.
It was ridiculous. Right? It was so much more difficult than it needed to be.
Yes, it was hopeless in the beginning and, like, fraught with peril. And then Ollie Gordon going bonkers. I think he had 5 touchdowns. I don't think they threw a touchdown pass in that game.
No, I don't think so.
And then, you know, them improbably finding a way to win. It's literally the arc of their entire season.
Winning the game then until they missed the PAT and then having to win it again and, you know, doing so. It was ridiculous.
Yes.
So any hope at all? I won't even ask if Iowa can win. Can Iowa score? Can they come close to staying inside the number? I mean, you know, we've kind of poked some fun at Iowa's offense, and they've earned that. I mean, every time I see Kirk Ferentz in the post game, I feel so badly for him because I know that he wants to celebrate the accomplishment, yet it's offset by the situation surrounding his son, who has proven to be a really good offensive line coach over the years. And, you know, the offense hasn't worked. So they're making the change, and I know that's very painful personally. But even if you were to get on the Iowa bandwagon, the great defense, the great punting, all of that, their top players are injured. I mean, they're not even coming into this game full strength. Yep. And it's a testament to the accomplishment that they won their division and they got there. And it appears that this is going to be very much like the meeting 2 years ago in the Big Ten championship game where Michigan, you know, just ran through them with ease. I think it was 42-3.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this defense gets better every year. It doesn't even seem to matter who they lose. You know, my joke after the game last Friday was that they had to throw that crippling interception to give themselves a chance to win. and that's exactly how it played out. They had to give the ball back to Nebraska so they could force a turnover and go kick the game winning field goal. And then they did it. I mean, that's the answer as far as scoring or staying. Like, they're going to have to force turnovers. They're going to have to get a long punt return. They're going to have to do the things that they always do against the Big Ten West, but really aren't equipped. And if I'm Kurt Ferentz, I'm certainly frustrated having to answer questions about a bad offense when my team's 10-2 and won the West and all that stuff. But they're 132nd in success rate. They go 3-and-out. They're sixth worst. They're 128th in 3-and-outs. They make no big plays. Their red zone touchdown rate is second worst in the country. I only feel so bad when he's the one who hired his son in the first place and kept him employed and all that other stuff. And it's just there. It's inexcusably bad.
Right.
It gives run first conservative offense a bad name when they can't run. They can't run. They can't execute. And yeah, their one chance is forcing a ton of turnovers, which is, you know, non-zero, but not great.
You know, the goal was to score 325 points this year. You know, that got a lot of attention on the internet. They fell 109 points short of that.
Yeah.
They're averaging 18 points per game. I mean,
they took the fun out of that. That was I was really enjoying, I had a drive to 325 in my weekly Sunday night column. And halfway through the season, I'm like, what's the point of this? They're not even going to come close. They're not even trying to come close. And, you know, they didn't come close.
Their identity this year was going to be 12 personnel. They had two great tight ends. And they obviously had Cade McNamara, a good game manager for a conservative offense. And both tight ends, Eric All and Lachey, got hurt. And Cade McNamara got hurt. And their best offensive weapon, cornerback Cooper DeShean, got hurt. And he was their best special team / pick sixer. And so, here they are. It is amazing how they've gotten here, and just completely unsurprising.
Well, and think about this too, guys. I mean, what they're 10-2, and although I've seen the fair catch signal called in that way before, but had they not ruled that Cooper DeShean signaled for a fair catch, they would have beaten Minnesota on a punt return. They'd have one loss, and we would be left saying, look, sort of like Louisville prior to the Kentucky loss last week. You can say what you want about their schedule, but they have a chance to be a one loss Power 5 conference champion. So they're that close to that. But if you say that, you also have to acknowledge the number of times that they, escaped and got the win. So I don't think this game is going to be terribly competitive. Michigan's going to steamroll them on their way to the playoff.
Yep. Yeah. No, Michigan has proven over time, like, they do not give you hope in these games. It would be the first time in quite a while that they gave an outman team hope like this.
So I think we've hit everything except the SEC, Alabama and Georgia. This Alabama team has found ways to rally. They've increased their own degree of difficulty, not just in the Auburn game, but several times over the course of the season. Yet they've shown the ability to finish games, come back in the clutch. Both teams are a little bit different in that they've been hit for big running games a couple of times. I look back, Bill, Georgia has allowed 200-plus yards rushing twice this season, once to Auburn, just as Alabama did, and also to Georgia Tech in their most recent game. Prior to this season, you have to go back to 2018 to find a game in which Georgia allowed 200 yards rushing. And now with Jalen Milroe and the opportunity for the broken play, scramble, keep plays alive, moving the chains, this is a little bit of a different dynamic for the Georgia defense, which still, while excellent, doesn't have as much as it has had in recent years because all those guys, as I've said numerous times, are playing for the Philadelphia Eagles now. So I think that's where Alabama has the chance for the upset, is Milroe having a big day, particularly moving the chains on third down. If you're going to throw the ball, do it before you pass the line of scrimmage. And then, you know, otherwise making plays with his legs.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. They've, you know, excluding garbage time, they've allowed at least 4 yards on 49% of carries this year, which ranks 84th in my numbers. And, you know, Alabama doesn't, they're not a ruthlessly efficient, they're not getting 7 yards per carry, but they're not moving backwards when they run the ball. They always convert on short yardage when they're running the ball. And so, yeah, you can certainly piece together a pretty good ball control script for Alabama. And they're going to need to control the ball because Georgia's offense has, you know, even though they've barely had McConkie and Bowers healthy at the same time, they are ruthlessly efficient. You know, it's Saban's old line about it's plays or players, not plays. Georgia seems to have the best version of, all right, well, 3rd and 6, time to go to Bowers. Third and 5, time to go to McConkie. 1st and 10, time to go to Rosemary Jack Saint on the outside. They just seem to pick the player they're going to go to and then call a play for him, and it works constantly. So, Georgia's going to score even against a good Alabama defense. This is probably the best Alabama defense since 2018, and Georgia's still going to score. So Alabama's going to have to manage a game pretty well. I do think, with what we saw against LSU, where suddenly Milroe was running a lot more, it does, like, I think a lot of the kind of the elite coaches figured out, like, we can't run our running quarterback 15 times a game every game, but we can do it in the big games. And I think we're going to see a lot of Milroe, and I think it's going to work pretty well. And that's going to give them a shot, even though Georgia's favored for obvious reasons.
You know who has been an absolute godsend, guys, for Georgia? Dylan Bell. Bell has done a little bit of everything. He's run the ball as a running back. He's a wide receiver by trade. He's thrown the ball, and he's made big plays in the passing game, particularly in the latter stages of the season. If you're looking for an under-the-radar X factor, particularly, you know, if Bowers is not 100%, or if, you know, Bowers aggravates that ankle, which, you know, I'm told by some people has been, you know, it came back quickly, then, you know, a little fits and starts maybe in terms of recovering. 86 for the Dogs has been a dude when they've needed him the most.
Yeah, and it's funny too, looking at, I think Bell and Rosemary Jack Saint both are kind of the unheralded, like, I'm just going to say MRJ because I'm always worried I'm going to spit out that name too fast. But, you know,
I want to say Rosemary, right? Like the spice. That's right. Every time I look at it, I'm like.
And of course, Jackson is right there too. Rosemary Jackson.
Yeah.
But he's not on the field a ton. But when he's on the field, it's very likely he's going to get targeted, and it's probably going to work. He hasn't dropped a pass all season. Well, my drop rates, I don't think I updated it for Georgia Tech. I don't remember him dropping a pass against Georgia Tech. But he's really reliable. He's the big play guy, and they have no problem. If he's on the field, he's probably getting a look, and it's really – I mean, they're just so deep. Edwards and Milton, we haven't said their names yet. They've just got a lot of really good weapons. And I didn't love the Mike Bobo hire, but I figured, you know, he hasn't worked with that set of athletes in quite a while. And it turns out, you know, he's pretty good at it. So I don't know about Broyles' finalist good, but, you know, it's hard to complain. They've been really efficient.
And I think Bell, to accentuate your point, has been like a little bit of Bobo's flair, right? Like Kirby's not going to turn into Sean Lewis, right, and go four verts and that. So you have to find creativity where you can. And the creativity has come through using Bell as a little bit of a Swiss Army knife. And, I mean, the best coaches maximize what they have with talent. And I think Georgia's done a really good job with that.
In the playoff era, and this is the 10th year of it, we've had number one lose. Georgia was number one lost, but they didn't fall out of the top four. It appears this year if Georgia loses, there's a really good chance of them falling out of the top four. Do you guys think if Alabama pulls the upset that Georgia's done?
Or likely done.
Look, if there are other upsets and there and you're just right. you're deciding between Georgia and Ohio State, you know, and to lose and say Washington, if it loses, then Georgia's probably going to stay in. But I mean, if you have the most likely scenarios, that there's not really room for them.
Yeah, no, I don't think if you're Georgia, you want to find out. I do think that we're looking at a, you know, it's just because the field is so crowded, we haven't experienced this kind of ending before, and we don't know how the committee will handle it at all. It's very possible that, you know, as I was saying earlier, Texas, their head-to-head win over Alabama might block Alabama from passing Georgia, and therefore Georgia ends up benefiting because of it. But yeah, you don't want to find out if Texas has one loss, if Alabama just beat you and has one loss, you don't want to find out how that's going to play out. I think it's quite possible they stay at four, but we don't know. We don't know how they, of all the precedents we've seen through the years, we don't really know how the committee would handle this. So yeah, my recommendation is to win. That's probably the safest alternative there.
Let me wrap with this dour thought. The reason why Georgia would get left out if they lost is because they didn't play anyone in the non-conference. The reason they didn't play anyone in the non-conference is because Oklahoma was pulled off their schedule because they were joining the SEC. So could this be some bizarre coda of SEC greed as they go and cannibalize the world? They actually prevent their own domination. Like, there's some big thought piece essay there of the collision of those ideas that I think is fairly interesting.
If Bill, let's wrap right here. Who are the four best teams according to SP Plus? Because we always get into this, you know, you match it to, I call it a mosaic, and depending on what you like more is what informs the subjectivity of this, which we wanted. Because, oh, the BCS is evil and we hate the computers. And now people don't like the judgment. Basically, what it means is that fans say, if you don't agree with me, you are biased and wrong and evil. So just give me the who are the four best teams, according to SP Plus, that would give us the four best teams playing for the national championship?
Yeah, I feel like you're trying to prompt a rant from me here because once again, Bill Hancock said last night, most deserving isn't even in our vocabulary. We're just going for best. If we're going for best, then Ohio State has their spot locked up because they would be favored over anybody in the country besides Georgia and Michigan. Therefore, they're one of the four best. And that's not how this goes. They always pick the most deserving, and they should pick the most deserving. And they always say they pick the best, and I feel like they're just tweaking me personally because of it, because it drives me crazy. But the four best teams right now are Michigan, Georgia, Ohio State, and Oregon. Those are, you know, Oregon was, like I was saying earlier, they're probably better than Washington the first time around, but they lost the fourth downs, and they've been dramatically better than Washington since. So that's... If we're talking pure quality and who would beat whom, the top four teams right now are Michigan, Georgia, Ohio State, and Oregon.
So there you go. Committee should listen to that.
That's right. They don't even need to watch the games this weekend. Yep. Those are the best teams.
Those are the best teams, depending on what happens.
That's right. Bill,
subscribe to ESPN Plus. There's your
and subscribe to this College Game Day podcast. Bill, always a pleasure. Great to have you on. Great insight there. We'll be back with the Picks Pod, final one of the season later on. We urge you to subscribe to the pod. If not, you can download this wherever you prefer to get your podcasts.